Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host. Today we have a quick pitch from Shoshana Kitz-Jaskel before we get started with our episode. This is an important cause, and I urge you to listen through and to donate whatever you can to Chochmat Nashim. I fully support the work that they're doing. Have in mind, this intro with Shoshana is almost 7 minutes long, and my new music video, Melody of Miriam, is finally out for Pesach, representing breaking out of our chains in the most literal and metaphorical sense. The link will be in the show notes. I can't wait for you to watch it, share it. Kol Yishev. This is a Jewish Coffeehouse podcast. And let's get started with our 6 minute intro with Shoshana Kitz-Jaskel, and then on to the guest for today, Molly Goldschmidt, my sister in law.
I think I absolutely suck at it.
You don't suck at it. Whenever I ask, I just say, this is for our sisters, our daughters. So, yeah, it could be hard to fundraise.
People don't know where their money's going half the time.
I'm shaping, with the community's help, the future of Judaism, because we have to.
We're putting women back in the picture. We understand the erasure is a problem. Now we have the Jewish Life Photo Bank, which has over 2,000 images and counting of Jewish women, girls, and families that people use to represent Orthodox women because they didn't exist before. And now people want to use them. It's the Rate My Beitin. What does that mean? So you have Batei Din, you have courts, and they're not great sometimes or a lot of the times, but what can we do about it? So we have projects that actually help us make change in the courts. And we know they're listening because I've gotten irate emails. How could you give us a 4.2? How could you give us a 3.5? What do you mean? And I said, well, do you have your information on your Beit Din website? No. Does the woman know what the procedure is? Do you hand something to her? No. So, okay, I think these are things that you can do to tell her to come with representation. Why? Well, and then we talk about it. So we're actually improving the status of the Batei Din, the procedures in the Batei Din, just by having some transparency and letting people know that we're looking in over your shoulder. So there are projects like that. And then there's the individuals, the people who come to us and say anything from, I'm an agunan, I need help, to, I want women on my shul board. I want women to come and speak to my shul. I want to understand how I can prevent my daughter from becoming an agunah. And so now we have people taking action locally, but with resources, tools, and the understanding of how to do it. And that change is evident in the community. So I am spending my days writing, advocating, speaking, talking to people and individuals and helping them out, talking to people like you and saying, this is what the community can do. And we go to the Knesset and we talk about policies that need to change. We collaborate with other organizations and changing Batei here.
Okay, share some wins, specific stories.
Well, okay, so I have an individual story that I'm actually so proud of that actually just happened last week, so it's fresh in my mind. I got a phone call from a woman who had been in Aguna, and her mother had called us a few years back for help. We got her representation, we protested for her, we took care of her, we followed her through and got her her get. Didn't hear from her for a while. We spoke back and forth, how are you, I'm okay. She was struggling as a single mom. I got a phone call from her last week. Shoshana, I'm getting remarried. What prenup should I sign? It was like a full circle situation of someone who was in a horrible marriage and in a horrible situation, had to get free. She got freed and then didn't give up on marriage, didn't give up on love, and didn't give up on Judaism because we were there to say, we will help you. This isn't the whole system. This isn't Judaism. This is just abuse, and we're going to help you take care of it. And she saw an out, and now she's getting remarried halachically, but protecting herself. We have now people signing on to say, I'm going to support women who are getting halachic solutions when they can't get their gets. That would never have happened even 2 years ago. It's a retroactive voiding of the marriage. We can then say, listen, we're going to look into this marriage and see if it was not valid to begin with. So you can give a get, or you can insist on being abusive, and we will see if we can void this marriage. And most of the time, the threat of using the void of the marriage will get the get, which is the ideal situation.
Anything else you wanted to add?
Listen, it's 6 months into this horrible war. And it's hard for people sometimes to say, well, why am I going to give to this? Why is this important? Hashem tells us all the time, you have to fix what's wrong inside. Don't abandon the orphan. Don't abandon the widow. Hashem says, if you do these things, I will take care of you. If you don't do these things, you will fall under the sword. Look up Shemot 22:22. It's devastating. Those of us who care about the Jewish community, Israel, the Jewish world, will say, I cannot personally, other than davening, do anything for those hostages or for those who have lost their children in this war or parents in this war. But I can do my part in fixing the Jewish community. I can do my part in donating to those who are helping the most vulnerable. And if that means $18, if it means $1,800, if it means $18,000, we all have the responsibility to take care of one another.
It's easy to fundraise for Hatzalah,
yes,
or for Zaka or Bikur Cholim. Here, this is a controversial area. I hear people say all the time, Agunot are not widows. Don't put them in the same class as orphans and widows. And Aguna is not even what Aguna used to be, misinterpreting the word, because the original Aguna are people who are missing, not who are abusing their wives, potentially. And then you have all the people who are saying it's not abuse. The women are the ones who are abusive and screaming. So there's a lot of educating to do around this. It's not as simple.
100%. A woman who is a misurevet get, which is what we technically have today, which is someone who's being denied a get, not a technical aguna whose husband is missing, is worse off in a sense because the community is allowing abuse. And it makes the community immune to abuse. And that's a really dangerous place to be. You know, it's kind of like when you live in a city and you're used to walking past someone who's homeless. I remember being in college, I was in Stern. And the first few homeless people I saw, I literally gave them my socks, my jacket, my food. I bought food for every single homeless person I saw because it was shocking, it was painful, and I felt like I had to do something. Fast forward, after you live in the city for a month, you can't do that all the time. So you get used to walking past someone in pain. And I felt a little bit of that humanity in me going away. And it made me really sad that I got used to walking past someone who was hungry and not doing anything. And I do think that it is dangerous for a community to get used to seeing, accepting, and looking the other way for abuse. And so I would say that for women and men who are being denied a Jewish divorce, it's abuse.
Let's see change happening.
Amen. Thank you so much.
The difference between Chofmat Nashim and so many other organizations that are doing incredible things is that there's actually something we can do to prevent further abuse from happening. This is not a case of an orphan or a death. This is not a case of illness. We're talking about human behavior and cultural norms, things we can do to make Judaism better for the future in the next few years, better for our children. So go ahead, make a donation. Chodesh Tov. I cannot wait to hear your eclipse stories. And here we go. Enjoy the show.
Molly Goldschmidt, welcome to the Franziska Show. It's so good to have you.
It's a real honor to be here. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself professionally and religiously, and then we'll get into our topic.
My name is Molly Brunner Goldschmidt. I'm 24 years old. I'm married for 4 years now to Freddie's amazing brother, Ellie. I work as an electrical engineer. I've been in the high-tech industry, or more correctly, the semiconductor industry for 4+ years now. I'm studying now for my master's in cybersecurity, which is going to be very interesting.
You grew up Haredi Israeli?
So I grew up in a bit of a limbo between being Israeli and my parents being European, but attending mainstream Haredi schools. It was a little bit of a niche, but I wasn't there alone because there's quite a big percentage of that population in Jerusalem. So even though it wasn't the typical, I had enough friends and neighbors and family friends to pull me through.
So our topic for today is, you first wanted to come on because you had an idea. Then my mother suggested talking about how no one goes into teaching, like amazing women like you should be the teachers of our next generation. Instead, you are working for American companies. And we're also connecting this a little bit with an episode we did a few weeks ago with Dr. Daniel Edelman talking about Haredi women going into the sciences. So let's talk about the opportunities, possibilities, what are the challenges, and then the reasons women go into the industries they do. the support systems, and then my chat can go after and just criticize everything about this.
No problem. Hit me up. I will make a small disclaimer. I did quite a bit of reading up and research and went through quite a few rabbit holes of information. Such a fascinating topic. I had a lot of gut feelings about what I thought was true, what I met and heard from other women in this field. And then looking at the numbers, it was very interesting to see what was right and what was wrong. So any numbers, figures, statistics that I quote are from the Bureau of Statistics in Israel. And if you want to get the more detailed stuff, you can contact me directly. I will send you gladly.
We can also link it in the show notes. Tell us what preconceptions you had. Yeah.
I guess growing up in a school, and this is the numbers as of this year, I graduated 4 years ago when I started working. And the feeling in the Haredi Beis Yaakov high schools, which is where I studied, is that around a third to a half of each year will be going into the field of STEM, which typically means programming. So that feeling is not always reflected in the industry, because you're in your class and you're saying around a third to a half of girls are going to be going into programming. So you have this feeling that you're going to go into a company and every other person you're going to see is going to be Haredi. But then you go out into the wide world and you are completely culture shocked. You go into companies that are irreligious at best, antagonistic or whatever in the more realistic, practical cases. And personally for me, I went into a completely, completely secular, very, very not aware, not used to Haredi women. It was an extreme culture shock. I went from being very, very sheltered, all-female school and teachers, besides a few rabbanim teaching halacha, which very, very far from the people in the industry. And it was absolutely shocking. I remember coming back home. I was still single when I started working and sitting down and just like taking it all in and telling my mother, I feel like I need to take a shower, like a religious shower to just like cleanse from all what I felt was like so foreign religiously, culturally. It was.
What are you referring to? Are you talking about dress, speech?
Everything. Everything is so very different than what you're used to as a Beis Yaakov girl. You walk in and you have people who are dressed differently, who talk differently, who walk differently, who every single facet of their life is very different than yours. And I grew up in a Haredi neighborhood, but I have traveled abroad a lot. I have family, not immediate family, but I have further family relatives who are not religious. And yet it has been insanely, I'm not sure what the word is, but it was like a recalibration of everything I knew until then.
Have you adjusted by now, or you still feel like it's night and day?
I did adjust. I learned very much not to listen and not to look to things I didn't want to be exposed to. And I think that transitioning to working from home during COVID, it's sort of brought a certain barrier to the amount that I'm exposed to. But I could say that when I go on campus, which is once a week now, it's a very hard day for me. It's very challenging. It's very, very hard to be the person that you are and not be affected by your surroundings and yet be friendly, professional, part of the team, doing what everyone else is doing and be a part.
Do you feel like you are in a constant state of triaging, sort of, where you're like, this is kosher, this is not kosher, and you're judging any piece of information that's coming through, or you're just walking around with one big barrier to keep a distance? Or is the uncomfortable part of it is that you just stick out like a thorn and you don't like, you're used to being like everyone else, and suddenly you're a stereotype and you're representing something so foreign to them?
Right. So this is actually something that I realized yesterday with mommy, that it would be something that I'd want to bring up here, is that the first phase of working, which I'd say took like 3 to 9 months, which is when you learn the new job and you learn your new peers and everything that it entails, that's when the shock set in. I moved on from that. And what I feel like today is a very big sense of Kiddush Hashem, because a lot of the people I work with have never been exposed on a first basis of a Samad Haredi. And very often I go to a lecture at work, or I meet new team members, or I meet another team, or anything else of people that have not met me before. And I just love that first second when their jaw drops and they're like, what is this Haredi lady doing here? I work in a field that is mainly male. And being a woman and Haredi is very foreign to them. And when I manage to be professional and get the job done, I have immense satisfaction from making a Kiddush Hashem. And I think that Haredi women have here a very big power that they can choose to use, because a lot of the people that come across in these kind of places, it might be their only experience with Haredi ladies or Haredi people at all.
So when I think of Haredi women going into STEM and engineering, what did you call it before?
Semiconductors.
Semiconductors. I'm imagining these Lakewood office buildings where you have a bunch of from women sitting in different cubicles talking about what they're making for Shabbos, you know, during the water fountain cooler talk. So you're saying even though a third of the graduates go into this industry, you're still the minority. Well, you're one in your entire company.
It depends on where you end up working. There are a few places where you'll be in a total base Yaakov environment. You'll work with 90% from women and you'll have the recipe exchange and the pre-Shabbos discussions. But very, very often you will work in a very secular environment. I work on a campus that has around 8,000 employees. There are 4 Haredi women and someone's usually on maternity leave. So if you're wearing a skirt, you are very, very weird in scenery.
And that's in Israel. And hold on, is this an American company or is this an Israeli company?
It's an international company. It's Intel Electronics. It has bases in Israel and all over the world.
What did you want to talk about?
I'm not really sure, because when I started looking at the information, I was amazed with how my gut feeling was really correct about how women have been going more and more into higher education, although it's not encouraged in Beit Yaakov. It's changing, but it was never encouraged historically. And they're going more and more into the fields of STEM, and not only programming, which was always the sort of route that was mapped out for them. And I think there's a lot of challenges along the way. Not all of them are addressed. Some of them have people who are opening like forums and sources to help these women brave what they're going through. But I think it's something that's not so much discussed.
So what was your bias?
What do you mean?
You said you suspected something and then the data confirmed.
I was looking into basically, first of all, general statistics. I went outer in and I looked at how many people identify as Haredi these days and how much the numbers have grown, what's the suspected growth rate. And I think we all know this, but the Haredi sector multiplies quicker than other sectors in Israel, even though that growth rate is slowing down, which is something interesting to point out. And what happens is that bigger families require more financial aid, or whatever you want to call it, and they have to manage somehow. So these families have to manage somehow, and they have to raise an average of 6 point something kids. How are they going to do it? So the government had a lot of incentives to get Haredi women and men to have higher incomes. It used to be historically that women used to go almost exclusively into education. And as we all know, it's not the most exciting field financially.
Lucrative. Yeah.
The government opened up a bunch of programs to incentivize Haredi men and women to go into other fields. And what happened is that a lot of the Beis Yaakov high schools started opening up these tracks to train women to go into programming, mainly programming. And it sort of backfired on the government, at least, because what happened is that when Haredi women went all for it and they started learning it like crazy, going into the field, just in the last 3 years, the amount of Haredi women in high tech has tripled, which is crazy. And it just keeps getting more and more. And what has happened as a byproduct of that is that they are making big enough salaries to keep their husbands in Kailo. So if you look at the government's perspective of things, they allowed a situation which they didn't really want to happen. So that is very interesting. Although...
And now they don't have teachers.
Now they don't have teachers. So that's a very interesting thing that's happening, is that all these girls are going into STEM, and that leaves a very small percentage of girls who go into education. The girls who go into education is either for idealistic reasons, which is unfortunately not most of them, or the girls who didn't make it. And it causes this major gap, which is honestly scary, where the teachers of the next generation are, I don't want to say the bottom of the barrel, but
really the bottom of the barrel.
Really not the people that you want educating your kids. Not necessarily. Again, there's those idealistic individuals, but the general rule of thumb is that it's not the sharpest pencils. And it's a sad reality.
And hold on, are there any other fields Haredi women go into?
Graphic design, accounting, architecture, interior design. Depending on the school, there will be a music track. Nothing in the worlds of psychology or the arts or anything like that.
Health. Or health, nursing.
So that's not in the Haredi high schools, but there are a lot of tracks for religious women, and it's a growing field.
Because in America, you have physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, ABA therapy, all these from right. specialties.
So it's not fields that they have in the high schools, but a lot of girls leave after 12th grade instead of continuing in the tracks. And they'll go to speech therapy. A lot of girls go to learn nursing. It's like a growing field in the last few years. Yeah, it's whatever the BC Outcomes are offering is not enough.
Well, high school's usually not enough. You have to go right. somewhere after.
When I say BC Outcomes high schools, the way that it's structured in Israel is that you'll finish 12th grade and then you'll have another 2 or 3 years of professional training. It's not a degree, although some high schools in the last few years have started bringing the degree training in to the school, because it always used to be like a big, big no-no. You didn't go for a degree. You used to get your professional training. It's called practical engineering. It's not an engineering degree. And that used to be mostly enough to manage to get into the industry. Last few years, a lot of girls have left after 12th grade, saying it's not enough not to have a degree, going out and finding a place to do it. There are Haredi environments to do it in, questionable, but existing. And the schools realize that they're losing students. So some schools brought it in. Some schools have come to an agreement with universities, figured out all kind of ways to have it, to have the degree, but keep it in the house.
And you said the birth rate went down.
The birth rate has slowly gone down. You would think that the Haredi sector has, like, I don't know, a 7 or 8 average. That was always my feeling. And the average is at like 6 point something.
And what did it used to be 10 years ago?
That's a good point. There isn't a lot of data. The problem with getting accurate data on these kind of things is that you can't always get the data with the sector. So it's a little bit of a problem. I have a graph somewhere here about it.
And you would have gone into teaching if it paid more? Like, what's your job satisfaction?
That's a very good question. I feel like I'm a very unique set of skills because I do enjoy also the more artistic, creative, generative stuff. But also, I love numbers. I love data. I love analyzing things. I don't think I would be able to give that up. So I did do my bachelor's in education. If I ever want to go into the field and it would be worth my while, I would do it. I love teaching. I love demonstrating. I give at work a lot of courses, workshops, lectures, whenever I have the opportunity, I love doing it. And I looked into teaching a few times. If you are professional, if you've worked in the field, you have where to look to teach in the Beis Yaakov high schools. It's just, you're putting yourself out of the race because to teach and to work is almost not possible.
You spoke about the government trying to create programs for Haredi men and women to incentivize them to go into higher paying jobs, careers. So can you talk about the issue with Haredim working because they don't go to the army, so it's harder for them to get jobs? Isn't that the condition?
No. The problem with Haredim going into higher paying jobs, let's separate between men and women. So men generally in Cheder have general studies up to a very minimal in lower grades. They'll stop learning English at fourth or third grade. Math's pretty much the same. They're lacking a lot of basic studies. Once they want to start completing their higher education, they'll have to do something called mechina, which they complete their matriculations, the bagrut. And then they have to go through quite a bit of schooling until they can even get to their to the opening position of anyone who's gone to a public school here.
Or a girls' school.
Or a girls' school. So the girls' school are a little different. Most Beis Yaakovs will give you the full, not full, but almost full matriculation exams. And then you are good to go if you want to start your degree. The professional tracks also give you a practical engineering degree, which knocks off some of your credits if you want to go afterwards to complete your degree. But in general, completing your degree in Israel is a little more of a hassle than in America. They don't recognize almost any credits from your high school studies. In America, they can recognize up to 90 credits. In Israel, it's up to like 30 or 33. It's pretty not exciting.
I never heard of 90 credits from high school, from college.
High school, from any, if you took, let's say, a practical engineering degree and you have a lot of your matriculations, you can come up to 90.
Oh, you keep referring to high school, but that's 13th and 14th grade. So, okay.
Depends on the school. I started my professional track at the age of 14 in the 10th grade. So wait, let's go back to the working, Haredi men and women working. So Haredi women do have it easier to go out into the market. And you see from the year of 2009 until 2023, Haredi women are like skyrocketing up the numbers. They even passed the rate of women that are not Haredi, Jewish, but not Haredi in the workforce last year. It's gone down a little bit. COVID sort of messed with the data. And the men, although we all have this like preconception that Haredi men don't work, so according to the numbers, around 56% of Haredi men work or get some sort of income that does not include kollel stipends. It means actual work. And the real figure is probably somewhere around 70% because a lot of it is like off the books.
And you said the girls' schools almost give you the degree level education. Why can't they just fully do it? It's a hashkafic barrier.
So there used to be this like real, I'm not sure where it started, but there was this taboo on the whole getting a degree thing. I don't know why. In America, it's totally accepted. There was this, for years, it was like a real no-no. The girls who graduated 12th grade got like a whole speech about it. It was a topic that was discussed, going into academia, you never, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The last few years, but it really was a change that came from the bottom up. The girls who went into the field realized that not every company will accept you with just a practical engineering degree. A lot of companies will, but the bigger, more international companies won't. And either girls who were a few years in the industry started completing their degrees. They told their sisters, like, it's a waste of time to stay in high school. Go complete your degree. There were more and more places to go and do that in a Beis Yaakov-ish environment. And it really came from the bottom up. And the schools realized that if they want to keep their students and their tracks open, which a lot of these tracks are funded by the government, they will have to make some sort of change. So not all schools, but slowly the schools are adapting. Some schools have brought in like very advanced boot camps that are equivalent to a degree that will be recognized in most companies. Other schools have come to agreements with universities. The girls' studies will be recognized in those universities. They'll have to complete a semester or two, then they'll have the full degree in their hand. And the students and the parents are starting to demand this from the schools. Give us a valid option that the girls won't have to start from scratch if they do want to complete their degree, which is honestly a phenomenal change. I think it's great. Overdue.
There's the topic of the Haredi men not going to the army and not serving, but nobody ever talks about, I haven't heard anyone talk about the women who don't do their service. Is that a question and how is it answered?
I don't want to get too deep into that, but I will say a few things on the topic. So I can say I've seen upfront what it looks like to do Shirut Lomi, the full program. It's not an appropriate environment for a Beis Yaakov girl. It's usually in mixed settings. The girls are still in their raging hormone stages. If they're coming straight from a Beis Yaakov, it's really not an appropriate environment. And although I do see the value in doing that, and I think it's very, very important, I think the Haredi schools would benefit a lot from finding a way to incorporate that into the schools. Specifically, the Beis Yaakov High School that I went to, which is a very open-minded school in their scope and in their thinking, they offer the students to tutor younger students. The schools put in programs that have the same values of being community-minded and helping weaker students.
Now, my next question, which I forgot, and then you reminded me by talking about the exposure and the not appropriate environment for Haredi girls. Do you think it's ideal to not expose yourself, your community, your families to people who are not like you? Like, is that the ideal? Or do you feel like you've benefited and grown as a human after have been exposed to the real adult world? Meaning, there's one thing to want to insular your children, but once they're adults and not preparing them for the adult world, or is it in design for the people to never get exposed to that? Because there's nothing positive to gain from integrating. The reality is the Haredi women are integrating because that's where the money is and that's where opportunity is.
So I'm very fortunate to have grown up in a family that was never too sheltering in a positive sense. We traveled every year in the summer all over Europe and sometimes further. And I've seen a lot growing up. I've seen different types of people. My parents were very, very good at walking the fine line between sheltering us and teaching us about the world and what's out there. And yet, as I told you, it was a very extreme experience to be enmeshed in that on a day-to-day basis. I believe there is a lot to gain from going out there, seeing what's there, being exposed to other people, other cultures. I work with Arab colleagues closely, or Muslim colleagues more correctly, and I have a very good relationship with them. And I learned to be professional and work with secular men and not get too personal, which for me was not comfortable in the beginning. I think it's a very, very fine line. I think it teaches you a lot as a person to know how to navigate yourself in an environment that's very different than what you're used to. It's a very, very tough thing to learn on the job without preparation. And I think the high schools got that message and they brought in more content to the girls to explain them a little bit more about how to behave in an environment that's different. They brought in more speeches about what it's like, what to expect. There's a lot of halachic aspects also. I've had many, many questions over the years in Hilchos Yichud. I didn't know that you're not allowed to tell men or ask men certain questions, accepting gifts.
What questions are you not allowed to ask men?
It says the halachic term is lidrosh b'shlomo.
Which means?
Which means on a very simple level, it's not how are you doing, but more like in Hebrew, it's mashlomcha. In English, it's not exactly the equivalent because how are you doing is not exactly that. But I learned to just ask my male colleagues, makore, like what's going on, instead of how are you doing? Not really how are you doing, but a question, how are you doing and how are you feeling? you're not allowed to accept a gift from a man. I didn't know that. We have a incentive recognition program where if you help the colleague more than what you're meant to, more than your scope, they award you with a monetary recognition. I had many questions over the years, all kind of crazy things that you'd never even expect to come across. And you have to...
Examples.
So I almost never had the opportunity to sit next to men right on the same bench or right very close before, because the buses here have men in the front, women in the back. And suddenly you go into almost every single meeting, you have to either come in early and put your bag down next to you or make peace with the fact that you're going to be sitting next to men on both sides. They are very, very not used to what to you seems very normal. When I got engaged, I got so many questions. They were like on a field trip with what it means as a Haredi girl. They thought I was way too young to get married. They were sure I was going to live with my parents and start popping out babies. And they had so, so many questions about the whole idea. They were amazed to come to my wedding. It was like an exotic experience for them. They were like shtisseling me the whole time. It was
a nice wedding. It was an exotic experience.
They had and have so many questions. I get very, very often people that I've worked with just like chatting, emailing, and never actually meeting or even opening a Zoom camera. And then I meet them half the year down the line in real, and they're shocked. They're like, how are you a Haredi? What do you mean? You can't really be Haredi. You're a professional. This is not what they were expecting. Also, just walking around campus wearing a skirt that actually covers something is people turn around. They're not used to seeing that kind of thing. I personally find it very, very empowering. I love it. I don't mind being asked any questions. I don't answer every question, but I am very comfortable being asked. I enjoy being a window for them to the Haredi world.
How do you avoid answering a question?
So people will usually say, "Efshar lishol shela," and already on...
Can I ask a question?
Can I ask you a question? And usually on the tone, I already see where it's headed. And I usually know the people. So I always say, you can ask whatever you want. I'm not necessarily going to answer. And when I feel like I've gotten very inappropriate questions or questions that made me very uncomfortable to answer. So a lot of them get a lot of their education from TV shows, from books, from very extreme cases that make it to the news and very, very far removed from reality. So I very often have to tell them, my life is not shtisel. I'm not dying to break away. My husband's a great guy. I wasn't forced to be married to him. I had my choice. I'm very, very happy where I am. Is my world perfect? It's really not. But is yours perfect? I don't think so.
So your life is not shtisel.
My life is not shtisel.
Did you watch shtisel?
I watched certain segments. I honestly really don't like the whole idea of people who are not Haredi making shows or writing books or whatever it is about Haredi people. Although I know that they do a lot of research and a lot of the elements are true. I just feel like when you do such a thing, you're always giving your viewers a very partial outlook. And you have to be very careful when you think that you're exposing a certain sector to the public to make it authentic. I understand that there's obviously a need or a want for people to see what it's like to live a Haredi life, but I find it very, very hard to believe, and I see the questions that I'm getting, that they're not getting the full picture.
Well, all TV is like that. You choose one narrative,
100%.
And that's the lens you're getting it through. And they did try a lot to get, they did their research, as you said. And you will never have a Haredim put on a Haredi TV show. So it's not like there are any other better options. So,
but growing up, my parents had a lot of students and Chayalim and Chayalot coming to eat by us Shabbos meals. And the purpose was not Kiruv. The purpose was simply for them to experience a very average Shabbos meal by a family who was not instructed on Kiruv, and we made our mistakes and we weren't picture perfect, and just to get the authentic experience. I understand that not everyone's up for that, but I think that someone who's really interested will find the way to get the real stuff.
Okay. Is there anything that you wanted to cover that we didn't cover yet or that I didn't ask you?
I know that most of your listeners are not from Israel, and I think that the Haredi women workforce here and in America is very, very different, has different challenges, comes from a completely different background, deals with different stuff. I think there is a lack of understanding of what our workforce looks like. Not that there is a need for the American Jews to understand what we're going through, but it does look different. Even the hours are different. Everything is very, very different. And I see that when Jewish women see the from women here in what, when they ask me questions and they see what work like is really here, I think they get a new appreciation, because the women here work really, really hard. I know that most from women in America also work, but I get the feeling that the women here are going through something else. I think that deserves a lot of appreciation.
Tell me more. So you said the hours are different.
So American office hours, a full day is 9 to 5, starting out, like that's a normal day. An average Israeli full day is 8 to 5. That's tough. It's 9 hours a day. Some places will give you an hour lunch break. Some places will give you 40 minutes. Imagine a woman who has 4 kids and is juggling a 9-hour job. How does she do that? I can't.
Plus Sunday, 9 hours.
Plus Sunday, right. So Friday is not a work day. Some places will have some hours on Friday, but General Hydek doesn't. That's a full week.
You said they're working so much harder than the Americans.
I see it also with my non-Jewish American colleagues. The Israeli workers, I think maybe it's also a mentality thing and not just a from thing. They're like all in, they'll work over hours even when it's not 100% necessary. They're like die for their projects. The Americans are very clear cut. Like, this is my hours, this is my job, this is my work. Don't demand from me too much more.
I think it depends on the industry.
Probably. And also the company.
If you have an entrepreneur woman, she's probably never done. And healthcare, if you're not with a patient, there's nothing you could really be doing. Maybe notes or something, or developmental education. But it's not like you can see a 3-year-old at 9 p.m. Your hours will have to end at some point. So I think it depends on the industry.
I do want to make maybe one more point. Is about the Kiddush Hashem, or the Haredi women being the unexpected ambassadors to non-religious Jews. I've been on campus yesterday, the campus here in Jerusalem, not my working campus, down south. I think it's just a very interesting picture, because you have this secular company and then you have all these Haredi women walking around, and they are a major influence on the vibe, on the atmosphere. People are seeing women they wouldn't normally see, hearing even conversations they wouldn't normally hear. I think what I said before, the Haredi women in the workforce being the unexpected ambassadors, no one saw that coming, in my opinion. And I think it's an immense power that the women have. A lot of them realize it and capitalize on it, and a lot don't, especially the girls straight out of Beis Yaakov are so shell-shocked and so not sure what's going on with them that they like flounder and take some time to find their way. But I speak to friends and I'm always amazed with what a Kiddush Hashem they're making. They're giving a lot of people their very possibly only experience with from Jews. I hope we all try to make the best of it. Also, a very interesting phenomenon that's happening is that these women are going into very male-dominated fields, and it causes a certain masculine nature to develop in the women. And it's something that's researched. It's been the topic of quite a few PhDs of women here in Israel, that there is a certain role reversal happening in a lot of the Haredi households, where the man is home to take care of the kids in the afternoon, and he learns how to cook and how to take them to Gan and how to listen to them when they come back from school, and taking on more roles that typically would be the woman's. And the woman is taking on a lot of the roles that would typically be the man's, taking care of the finances, dealing with the numbers, doing paperwork and stuff that typically would be the man's job. Now, this is like a generalization. Obviously, this is not what every household looks like, but there's a lot to read about this. And it's an interesting thing to see. I don't know how healthy it is on the marriage dynamic, on the family dynamic. It used to be pretty much exclusively the man's decisions, the man's say in the Haredi sector. And that changing has very interesting side effects, one of them being divorce rates going up. And I think it's something to note because it's a great empowerment for the women. But I do think that there's something to lose here as well. I think the femininity that we naturally have is a beautiful thing. And myself, I'm not very feminine, but it's a beautiful place to be in. And I think we will have to learn how to juggle and maintain the fine line between being professional, being in the fields that we enjoy, and keeping the place that we want to be in.
So Shtisel did have that dynamic. It was, I think, Tzvi Aryeh and his wife. She wanted to learn how to drive because she needed to get to work, and he didn't want her to learn how to drive because how can you do that? So she gets her license and the car. She parks far away. I might totally be making this up, but I'm pretty sure those are the details. And then she walks home so he doesn't know she has the car. And then she's giving advice to someone else. She's saying, he just needs to know he's in charge. You actually make all the decisions, but he just needs to think that he's making all the decisions. That's the trick. That's the key. I remember learning that also in literature in Moscow, reading one of the Russian, how the man just needs to think that he's in charge. You're actually in charge because you're running the show. And by the way, you said you're not feminine. I would say you're a very balabusta type of woman, where maybe you're not like having heebie-jeebie things while you're making challah, and I don't know if you even make challah, but you're very into flowers and everything has to look a certain way, and the job is done whether you're like into it or not. Your goal is to have it done, and your Shabbos table looks beautiful based on what I hear from other people.
Thank you.
But the role reversal is a real thing, and that does have more to do with divorce rates, stay-at-home dads. And I'm not saying kollel husbands are stay-at-home dads, but there's a little bit of overlap on the job description.
And I don't think that the answer to this in any way is to discourage the women from going into these fields or having them earn less, which was a play that was done by a certain Haredi company. I don't think that's the answer. I think if the men are feeling inferior in any way, go and empower yourself. You have all the tools to do it. And people need to be aware. And you're saying, give the man the feeling that he's running the show. It's true, but men are not dumb either. They know when they're running the show or not, but I don't know what the answer is. It's obviously a complicated issue.
Do you think most men should stay in kollel?
I believe that there should be more of an incentive to be very serious about your learning if there'd be an option of and otherwise. I think a big percentage is doing it right and they're learning. And even if they're not 100% of their time maximizing, I don't believe anyone who works is maximizing 100% of their time either. I do believe there is a nice percentage, I'd say 15-20%, who would gain a lot from sort of seriousing up and going into the workforce, or whether the step before his army, whatever it is. I think there's a certain laziness, I'm saying this gently, that comes from knowing that nothing will happen to you because you're in kollel and no one really knows No one's checking on you. No one's your boss. You're not committed to any deadlines or to any project. And there's a certain laziness that comes as a byproduct. But I do think it's a smaller percentage than people like to think. And I think that most people are where they're meant to be. It's a hard topic because I see the Haredi women that work in high tech. There are a lot of them. And it's a very, very challenging environment. It's a fast-paced, very secular, very friendly environment. And it's if it's hard to be a woman in such an environment, it's probably a lot harder to be a man.
Interesting. I could hear it both ways, because if it's a mostly male-dominated industry, then it might be easier to be a man.
Religiously, it's harder, I think, to be a
man. Religiously, it's harder. Okay. Molly, thank you so much. And my most favorite part of this all is that you asked and you wanted to be on. I think there should be this assumption. I want most people on my podcast, if you're in my family especially. Menachem told me last night, so funny, everyone in your family wants to be on a podcast. Like, what's wrong with everyone? I'm kidding. No, but I just had his uncle on, so you don't have to worry.
I feel like everyone has a story to tell. And as typical as it is to say, we all have what to learn from one another. Everyone has their unique story. You happen to have an incredible family, and everyone's doing such amazing things. And this is also what Rachel told me. She confirmed what I always thought, is that you're exposing your audience to different types of people, to different stories, and bringing out topics that need maybe more of a spotlight. So you have a very interesting, colorful family. Why not?
And getting someone like you is very valuable, because on a smaller scale, just like Haredim aren't going to put out shtisel, Haredim also don't want to put out podcasts talking about Haredi culture and the data behind it and when things backfire after government programs are initiated. So thank you. Thank you for coming on, sharing this with us, and hopefully people get more information and exposure.
Thank you so much for having me. Really, really a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in today. I urge you to go and donate to Chochmat Nashim. This week they are fundraising. Please use my link. Last week I recorded Vehi She'amda, my first cover. It's on Spotify and YouTube. I will link that in the show notes as well. All the links will be in the show notes for you, including the link that Molly mentioned in the podcast. Stay tuned for my music video. Please reach out with comments and feedback, and I hope to see you next week. Stay safe.